Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download the club's iPhone or Android app for program and schedule information, as well as podcasts of past programs. I'm Dr. Karen Philbrick. I'm the Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute and your moderator for the afternoon portion of today's program. Today's program is co-sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University and by the Southwest Transportation Workforce Center based at California State University, Long Beach. And now it's my greatest pleasure to present our distinguished keynote speaker, Carolyn Flowers, Acting Administrator for the Federal Transit Administration. Carolyn Flowers joined the Federal Transit Administration in January of 2015, and on April 1st of this very year, she was named FTA Acting Administrator. Ms. Flowers leads an organization of more than 500 employees in Washington, D.C.'s headquarters office and 10 regional offices across our great nation. She implements an annual budget of over $10 billion. Her decades-long career serving in public transit provides FTA with invaluable insight and experience in delivering programs, policies, and initiatives. Please join me in warmly welcoming Carolyn Flowers.
Thank you, Karen. And I also want to acknowledge that I'm here today with our regional administrator from Region 10, Leslie Rogers. So it's great to be back in California. As you all know, I've worked here at Los Angeles Metro for about 19 years before I left and went to Charlotte, North Carolina. And so it's also important for me to take part in this very important conversation with each of you. So today, I want to look just over the horizon with you across the next decade or more. It's a time in which, spurred by no small part by the building of America's first high-speed rail service, we will be forced to solve a series of challenges here in California. They are challenges that we're already facing at a national level and that will only grow more urgent in the decades to come. Perhaps the biggest of these is how we can possibly hope to attract, educate, and retain a workforce that has been both the skills and the number to keep in this state and to keep our nation moving. As I'll share with you later, our transportation workforce is approaching what we can only be described as a demographic cliff, with a generation in the midst of retirement and too few stepping up to take their place. As is often the case, by facing this challenge first at the California scale, you will be developing solutions that will be replicated across the country. We're counting on you to do that. And that's why I'm not only here to share with you our view from the Federal Transit Administration, I'm also here to listen. So I want to thank the Mineta Transportation Institute for gathering us here today. On every important issue facing our nation's transportation networks, they were out front leading search for solutions. Here in California, their work to develop the official estimates of workforce needs generated by the high-speed rail project has given us a clear picture of the problem and its scope. Together, we can solve the problem in a way that not only ensures that we have a workforce with numbers and skills to succeed, but also, I believe, a greater diversity across all jobs for our frontline workers as well as our management teams. I want to begin today, though, with a question that may seem far from the topic at hand, in fact, 140 million miles away. And that is, why go to Mars? Well, we've been able to do some amazing research with semi-autonomous vehicles that in many cases have performed far beyond our most optimistic projections. The Opportunity rover, which landed on Mars in January 2004, is still operating there. That means it has exceeded its original mission by 12 years. And it's been joined by the Curiosity rover, which has done groundbreaking research. But still the dream, the desire persists to send women and men to the surface of Mars and then bring them back home safely. There are arguably good scientific reasons to do so. We've already found strong evidence that liquid water not only existed on Mars, but flows there in a limited fashion even today. We've also confirmed that the precursors for organic life exist there, and the habitat was once suitable for life. Going there ourselves could well help us piece together the clues that will answer one of the most persistent existential questions: are we, or are we always been, alone? That's not to mention the knowledge we could gain about climate science, a pressing concern for our own small planet. Some people will also argue that we need to go to Mars to help ensure the survival of humanity, or perhaps simply, but powerfully, to give us a common mission to work towards in these divided times. But I want you to consider a different question altogether. Why go to Mars? The answer? Because we don't know how. Some of you who follow science or even science fiction may be thinking, of course we know how to get to Mars. We even have some pretty good ideas on how to get back again. Matt Damon was stranded there for years and made it back. All of this is true, well, except for the Matt Damon part. So what's also true is that we haven't done it yet. And until we do, we don't really know how. We don't even know all of the obstacles that we'll face along the way or how to solve them. The closest analog, of course, is the mission to send people to the moon. When President Kennedy pledged that America would send a man to the moon and return him safely before the decade was out, he did so not knowing how to do it. Of course, going to the moon at that time was not only a mission of scientific importance, it was a mission around which the free world could rally in the face of advances by communism and the Soviet Union. And so America had many compelling reasons to go out to the moon, but in hindsight, one of the most important may have been we didn't know how. In the process of achieving that monumental goal, we had to pioneer better computers, materials, and human medicine. Indeed, today we live in an age of technological marvels, one of which we can literally hold in our hands, and I think many people have one in this room. That's our iPhones or our other phones. And that, holding that phone now, we have access to music, literature, and funny cat videos. That's in part thanks to the problems we solved in our journey to make it to the moon and back. So let me be clear, I am not, as acting administrator of the Federal Transit Administration, saying to you that we need to send humans to Mars or even that we should do so. That's not only outside of my purview, it's far, far, far outside of my budget. So I'm simply saying that if we decide to send women and men to Mars and bring them back home safely, it will require us to solve problems both foreseen and unforeseen, and the solutions could offer long-lasting benefits above and beyond the scientific goals. It is, to say the least, not nearly as far from Los Angeles to San Francisco as it is to Mars. Yet we build high-speed rail between the two, you can rest assured we're going to have to solve problems both foreseen and unforeseen. And in doing so, we will not only strengthen the economic backbone of this state and prove America's capabilities in advanced transportation, we will also learn how. Unlike going to the moon or Mars, this is not an entirely new frontier. As you well know, other countries have built and operated high-speed rail for decades now. Many of the how-to questions have ready answers, The tracks, the vehicles, the control technologies have been proven over time. But then, no one knows how to do it in America, because we haven't done it yet. And more to today's point, no one has done it yet with American workers. The Mineta Transportation Institute has estimated the workforce needs of this project at 22,000 jobs per $1 billion spent, with an estimated budget of $64 billion. That's a lot of jobs. But one of the things we don't know yet is how to attract and train all of those workers. Yes, we have evidence-based successful models for workforce development on which we can build. At the risk of pressing an analogy too far, some would even argue that this is not rocket science. But as I'll make it clear in just a moment, the scale of this problem here and across the country is enormous. The high-speed rail project alone could extend some 800 miles along the length of this state, crossing dozens of counties. And that's the least of it, because no one believes that high-speed rail will be successful unless it's tightly integrated with a multimodal transportation system that gives travelers plenty of choices on how to get to and from its stations. By virtue of the fact that I'm here today speaking to you, it should be clear that we in the Obama administration recognize that it is public transportation that will be the key to solving that challenge. But the transit workforce has issues of its own, which I would like to talk about in greater length with you today. Just as sending people to the moon has had lasting, epic-shaping residual benefits, just as sending people to Mars may shape the destiny of the 21st century in ways yet unforeseen, so too will conquering this great challenge help us solve problems that we're always going to face anyway, and whose solutions could be spurred on by the concentrated effort and intense urgency to solve them in the decade to come. Addressing our workforce needs will be a complex process. It will not take care of itself. We do not know how we're going to add new transit workers to meet growing demand, replace the great number who will be retiring over the next 10 to 15 years, and to get them all trained on rapidly changing technologies. But together, we're about to figure out how. I want to spend a little time sketching out for you the scope of the problem we faced in transportation, particularly in public transportation. Last year, the U.S. Departments of Transportation, Labor, and Education released a joint report on our workforce needs, beginning with 2012 data and projecting out to 2022. It's a 10-year time span, but note the goal line now is only 6 years away. So what did the report find? By 2022, the transportation industry as a whole is expected to add 417,000 net jobs. The average growth rate across the country's transportation subsectors is 11%. That's similar to both the overall economy and the infrastructure industry of which transportation is a part. But when you add separations to that, retirements, people leaving jobs for other fields, et cetera, the number of workers we'll need to hire balloons to approximately 4.6 million. That's more than double our current workforce. And our analysis indicates that annual job openings will be 68% greater than the number of students who are currently completing related educational programs. Now, public transportation is part of a subsector of the transportation industry that's formally classified as transit and ground passenger transportation. That sector includes bus and rail transit, along with intercity buses, taxis, charter buses, and school buses. For simplicity, I'm only going to refer to it as the transit sector, but know that it does include other job classifications as well. California is expected to see 22% job growth in transit from 2012 to 2022. Among the American cities that have the highest projected job growth rate in transit are San Francisco at 32%, San Diego at 33%, and Los Angeles at 18%. All of this is complicated by the fact that among transportation sectors, transit is number one in the percentage of workforce that's over 55. I know, I'm there and beyond. 55 is a great age, but you add 10 years to that, and suddenly we're looking at 35% of our workforce that's at or above retirement age. By comparison, about 22% of all American workers are over 55. Keep in mind that at some transit agencies, workers are able to retire with 30 years of service. So if you started right after high school, you could be retiring in your late 40s, which further complicates this issue. On the other hand, at the other end of the spectrum, more than half, or about 56% of American workers, are younger than 45. I wish. But in the transit sector, only 37% are younger than 45. Whichever way you slice it, we're heading toward that demographic cliff that I mentioned earlier. But wait, what about millennials? Aren't they a large group of young people who are looking for jobs? Well, I hate to break it to you, but while we were busy studying their every consumer preference, millennials were quietly and steadily becoming the single largest demographic in the workforce today, larger than Gen X and larger than baby boomers. The single largest cohort of millennials was born in 1990. In case you're used to thinking that the 90s were only a couple of years ago, those young people are now 25. And since that was indeed the biggest cohort, that means that the number of millennials coming into adulthood will only be declining from this point on out. So my point is simply that we cannot wait for the cavalry to arrive. That cannot be part of our strategy for solving our workforce needs. The cavalry is already on the way to the next fort. Now that we've seen how bleak the picture may be, let's talk about some of the positives, because we're going to need to build on those strengths. First, many of the jobs we have to offer have low barriers to entry. The exception, of course, is maintenance, which requires some pretty significant on-the-job training and/or apprenticeships. Second, many of the in-demand jobs pay very well, above the national median wage, and they come with good benefits. Across the country, transit and inner-city bus drivers make about $45,000 a year, and bus and truck mechanics and diesel engine specialists can make more than $46,000. Both of these are above the median household income in the United States. First-line supervisors can start out making an excess of $62,000 a year. Obviously, though, in cities like San Francisco, that may be higher because of the cost of living. The point is that on average, these are good family-supporting jobs. Third, transit has a better record of attracting a diverse workforce than other transportation sectors, but there's still work to be done there, too. Transit has the highest percentage of women in its workforce among transportation sectors, standing at 35%. We have a ways to go, however, if we're going to match the 47% of participation by women among all U.S. industries. We've also been successful in drawing employees from diverse backgrounds. 26% of bus operators are Black, and another 7% being some of ethnicity other than white. But note that in those higher skilled and higher paid mechanic jobs, 81% are white. Careers in the transit industry provide real ladders of opportunity for many. We should be able to expect that if people within that diverse workforce are given the opportunities, the training, and mentorship they need to earn career advancement, that the management and executive ranks will also reflect that diversity in the future. That is not the case today, though. And so in addition to the raw number of workers, we also need to be cognizant of the diversity of both our workforce and its management, making sure that everyone has the opportunity to compete for jobs that require greater skill and responsibility and that include higher pay and upward mobility. Now I've given you a lot of statistics to think about and to tweet, so let's be clear about what it all really means. It means that unless we work together to address the looming shortage of workers, buses are going to be behind schedule because there won't be enough drivers. And that means, of course, that people will be waiting longer, buses will be more crowded, and people will be late for work, for their doctor's appointments, or for wherever they need to go. Likewise, rail systems that today might see some delays due to track and signal problems can add employee illness, time off, and even training as major disruptions in the future. Slowed maintenance will mean that vehicles are out of service longer or get delayed maintenance and very likely will experience more breakdowns and higher operating costs. That's not to mention the cleaning, the security, and all of the necessary support jobs that keep a transit agency running. Today, these would be annoyances that would cause ridership to decline, but in 10 years, 30 years, they could be crippling to a system. And here's why. We know that California is already our most populous state, and it's one of the fastest growing in terms of raw numbers. At the national level, we're expecting to add 70 million more people by 2035, expanding our population by 25%. Today, transit ridership is at its highest since 1950s, and it's growing. We're going to need more transit service, not less. Here in California, the introduction of high-speed rail will make public transportation even more important. And so, this is the time in our nation's history when we should be making strategic investments to expand public transportation services and keep our existing infrastructure safe and reliable. And yet we may be stymied not by the lack of concrete or steel, but by the lack of people. We're on a course that will see transit services fail at the very moment when we need them the most, all because of a problem that we can see clearly coming over the horizon. What then can we do about it, and what are we already doing about it today? I'm confident the other presenters will be laying out a number of practical solutions, but I can't simply sketch out the extent of the problem without offering you some of our own solutions. Just this week, Vice President Biden and Dr. Jill Biden announced a new administration initiative to help students gain the skills that are in most demand by employers. These American Promise grants will make $100 million available to expand high-quality education and training programs. The goal is to pilot and bring to scale innovative tuition-free programs that are a partnership among employers, economic development organizations, workforce development boards, community and technical colleges, training programs, K-12 education, and community-based organizations. By doing so, we'll strengthen the pipeline of those already in-demand jobs, like those in transportation, bridge the gap between students' educational opportunities and the skills employers need, and create more pathways for Americans to reach the middle class. Encouraging more students to attend two-year institutions is a natural fit for California, whose community college system is the largest system of higher education in the nation. In fact, California community colleges serve 2.1 million students at 113 colleges throughout the state. In cities like Los Angeles, Oakland, San Diego, and Santa Barbara, some of them are joining President Obama's call to make two-year community colleges free. The America Promise grants announced this week are being made available through our colleagues at the U.S. Department of Labor, and I can tell you that Secretary Perez is not only aware of the tremendous workforce needs within transportation, but he's also been personally engaged in finding solutions. Last fall, he and I visited the Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority's Career Path programs in Ohio. Cleveland is working with their local community colleges, Cleveland State University, and community organization to build pathways to long-term careers for people who are new to the transit industry, as well as those who are in mid-career. The Career Paths program is one of 46 grantees across the country who shared in $175 million awarded by the Department of Labor in their American Apprenticeship Grant program. It's also one of the 18 organizations in 13 states that receive one of the Federal Transportation Administration's innovative public transportation workforce development grants last year. So you see that the Obama administration is reaching across the departments to combine resources that can help support and expand successful workforce programs. In California, FTA grants also went to workforce development programs in Los Angeles, Santa Clara County, and here in San Francisco. Locally, BART is working with community colleges and the workforce investment boards to build a transit career ladders training program, which will promote transportation careers in low-income areas, in unemployed and underemployed communities, and among minorities, veterans, and women, helping us build on and expand the diversity of our industry while creating ladders of opportunity. With funding tight, we've gave priority to projects like this one that will provide pathways to sustainable careers, tie in with the new transit capital projects, and address needs of areas with high unemployment. At the federal level, our resources to support workforce development programs are limited, making it even more important to work together with states, localities, community organizations, higher education, and K through 12. The nation's newest surface transportation law, known as the FAST Act, combines FTA research and workforce development funding together into one pot. So we've lost our dedicated funding for workforce development with these changes. That's going to lead to some tough choices as we seek to close this looming gap in our workforce while also investing in the technologies that are already making our nation's transit fleets cleaner and more efficient. The good news is the FAST Act also allows our grantees to use 0.5% of their allocation for human resources and training, in addition to 0.5% of their National Transit Institute training. That may not sound like a lot, and it does present a challenge for the operations side, but it comes to more than $76 million on a nationwide basis that's now available to support local workforce development, training, and education. These are all federal initiatives that seek to bolster local solutions conceived at the local level to meet local needs in partnership with local resources and know-how. So in closing, I started out noting that the big undertakings, a trip to the moon, to Mars, or to San Diego, can help us solve some big problems here. In his message to Congress in 1961, President Kennedy argued that America should continue researching both liquid and solid fuel boosters for the spacecraft because it wasn't clear at the time which would be the better technology. So remember, this was roughly 9 years from the time he pledged we would put a man on the moon, and we weren't even sure what engines would be used to do that. So let me suggest to you today that our transportation workforce is not a peripheral issue, not something that will take care of itself. Our transportation workforce is, in fact, much more akin to the engines that took us into orbit and beyond. We're not going to reach our goal unless our workforce is powerful enough, efficient enough, and smart enough to carry us there. And yet we're behind and losing ground. not to an external threat, not to another competitive nation, but to the reality of simple mathematics. We do not have enough people in school and in their early careers to make up for all the ones that are retiring and leaving for other jobs. And yet, to meet the demands of the future, we should be actually growing that pipeline at an extraordinary rate. There's no one here in this room today, or anywhere in California, or anywhere in the nation, who is solely responsible for solving this problem. There's no single government agency or initiative that can solve it either. Instead, we're going to have to take what we learn at gatherings like this one and build strong partnerships that recognize and take advantage of our different strengths. In fact, we don't even know how to solve this problem, but it's not a reason to shrink from it. On the contrary, it's the very reason we should pursue a solution wholeheartedly. And when we are successful, and when we've reached the journey's end, shoulder to shoulder, we can truly say, not knowing how was all the reason we needed to go there in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flowers. It's now time for our audience question period, and we have a number of them, so let's get started. We appreciate that fine presentation. Let's start with this nice softball. You're very sophisticated and knowledgeable and a fine role model. How did you gather those skills?
Well, I want to say that part of it was through training and leadership training that I had in my past. I've actually gone through programs with the American Transportation Association and with the Eno Foundation. So one of the things that I think is key to developing leaders is networking and mentoring. And so I can attribute, you know, some of the success that I have today to those relationships in the industry and having the training to get to where I am.
Thank you. We have a question from one of our millennials in the audience period, and that is, how do millennials like myself at the age of 23, who are trying to innovate, build partnerships with federal government to work and solve these transit problems you speak of?
First of all, we welcome you to come to work with us. but I think it's key that, you know, as we're talking about the pathways to the future, that we're flexible and open to new solutions and redefining what we're doing here in public transportation. We were just in a meeting, Leslie and I, that was a discussion with transportation network companies and members of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. And so we're sitting here redefining public transportation. It's not the traditional, this is bus, this is rail, but we're like redefining public transportation to look at the complementary technologies that are actually expanding public transportation. And so the voices for change are coming from the millennials and redirecting us in terms of how we perceive public transportation in the future. As we work with all of these new companies and look at new ideas, we have to work together to say, where is transportation going in the next 20 or 30 years and start developing those solutions?
Very good. We understand that the human capital shortage is being faced by all modes of transportation. And to that end, what efforts are being undertaken within the U.S. Department of Transportation to break down some of those modal-based silos with regard to workforce development?
Well, the Secretary has a one DOT approach. And so as we're looking at the trends for the future and how we develop our workforce for the future, he has put together forums that are across the agency to look at the transportation workforce needs for the future. I think the Federal Transit Administration has been out in front of this, but we're also trying to work with the Department of Education and the Department of Labor, because it isn't just a solution that is going to come out of the Department of Transportation. It's a partnership. And even here today, we're talking about the partnerships with the local level. to be integrated with our workforce development boards and to look at ways that we can all work together. The contribution on the financial side has to come from, I think, a compendium of organizations, and that as we look to build these partnerships, the only way that we're going to be aligned for the future is through those partnerships.
Very good. And from the podium, you mentioned the FTA Ladders of Opportunity grants and training programs and how those were being rolled out for low-income, underemployed communities. Can you give us an example of one of those successful grant proposals and what that looks like?
Well, I'll mention Los Angeles, which I'm familiar with. The Los Angeles Metro Transportation Group is associated with a partnership at LA Community Trade Tech College. And so through that program, that they're developing training for mechanics. And as one of the things that I've seen from being in the industry over a number of years is that a bus mechanic and a rail mechanic is now an electrician. And so you have to look at ways to bring up the skills of the workforce for the future. And as we're talking about changes in technology, we're talking about hybrid buses, we're talking about electric buses, we're talking about, you know, very sophisticated rail cars. We want to make sure that we have those skills in the future as we're, you know, battling the aging workforce. And so at LA Trade Tech, they have a partnership with with LA Metro to develop a workforce and train for the future. And what they've done is develop a program where they can have an apprenticeship with the agency.
Very good. Thank you for that example. And you're talking about some of the more technical skills, which leads nicely into the next question. What kinds of soft skills are most needed in the transit industry?
Well, there is always people skills, leadership skills that are needed. And you know, one of the things that I had to go through in my career is actually working with unions and negotiating with them. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the key things is having the ability to, I call it emotional intelligence, mm-hmm. basically being able to work with those who sometimes you have an inherent conflict with. And so I would say, you know, the leadership skills, the, you know, conflict resolution, the ability to work with people are key skills that you need in terms of management and supervisory levels.
Mm-hmm. Very good. You've come from Charlotte, the same system as Secretary Fox. That's quite a leap. From the city level to the federal level, how have you managed such a great transition?
Well, what I have today is the operational knowledge from being at LA Metro for 19 years and left there as the chief operations officer over bus operations, as well as 5 years at Charlotte Area Transit System. And so now I'm coming from the local level to the national level, but I think having the understanding of what is the core product, which is public transportation, and actually being able to bring that in from a practical perspective to work with our folks who are doing the regulations, who are developing the grants and looking at the capital investment projects for the future, I bring in a perspective of actually having been on the ground, actually having applied for all of the grants, mm-hmm. you know, actually having run a system. And so as we're developing our regulations and rules, I can add that perspective and hopefully guide us to something that will work when we put it out on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And that brings up a very good point, and I'm wondering if you can comment on how the players can all work more competently and effectively together, and that is academia, transit, and government. You bring a wealth of experience from the different sectors. What is your advice?
You know, a lot of it is transparency and trust. We have to basically look at what is the goal that we're all working toward. and taking that and leveraging the resources that we all bring to the table so that we can work together in a complementary manner to deliver, you know, something that is sustainable for the future. You know, I think that's one of the things that our secretary is doing in terms of looking at programs that we can work with on an effective basis with education, as well as health and human services, and with labor. And, you know, we all talk about public-private partnerships, and we look at public-private partnerships in terms of funding and financing, but really public-private partnerships are also the ability to take the resources that we have across the table and to put them together effectively, just like I'm looking at Cal State Long Beach. So if you have the educational organizations, the nonprofit organizations, and the public sector working together, I think that we can effectively deliver programs more efficiently in the future rather than trying to stay in these stovepipes.
Mm-hmm. Very good, and wholeheartedly agree. you mentioned the need to create a more diverse workforce. What some of us have seen in the education field is that when you're talking about careers in transportation to the K through 12 students, they can't really identify a position beyond airline pilot, bus driver, or train operator. How do we make those careers more exciting and more attainable for these K through 12 students?
Well, one of the things is that we have to be out there and be visible, and, you know, having an opportunity to go out and speak to students so that they can see that there's more jobs that are available. I mean, there's support positions. You know, I started out in public transit as a finance person. I actually never thought I would get into public transit. I have an MBA from UCLA. I never even considered that public transit would be something that I would get into. But I think when they see that, first of all, there are an array of positions that are available, that there are more than just the frontline positions that they see, you know, that behind that is a you know, whole support system. There's planning positions, there's construction positions, there's, you know, just, you know, finance, accountant, human resources, all of those, you know, support positions are actually there structured to help deliver the service. And so they have to know that there are all kind of jobs that are available to them in the public transportation industry.
Mm-hmm. And a follow-on question.
We have to tell our story.
We have to tell your story. Mm-hmm. And to that end, a follow-on question. If you were designing the ideal program for kindergartens to start them early and understanding those very jobs that are available, what would that look like to you?
I would take them out on field trips because that's where you expose them. You know, little kids who can go out and get on a bus, get on a train, and understand that this is a job. You know, I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, and a little boy and his mom came on the train, and I think we were doing a tour, and he asked, could he get in the cab of the train? Well, we were allowed to do that because the train was not moving, but just to expose them to the possibilities of the future. Kids are fascinated by things that move. You know, you just don't give them a book, show them. And so early on, they can develop curiosity and be able to see what is going on.
Very good. What advice do you have for local communities to prepare for the transportation jobs that are clearly on the horizon?
Well, the workforce development boards can be key partners with the transit agencies to work together to find training programs, to look at ways to get those who are not exposed to the industry. One of the things that I lament is that, you know, vocational programs are no longer available in a lot of high schools. And so the way that we're trying to develop those vocational skills now are through these partnerships with community colleges and trying to find a way to build the skills that are needed in the transit industry. So I, You know, I continue to say the partnerships are the way that we're going to get there, because we don't have the infrastructure in the educational system any longer that is basically developing those skills at the lower level. There are a few programs around the country, BART being one of them, who's trying to develop a program here. And I think San Francisco Muni is part of that too, where they're trying to develop, you know, high school programs. But, you know, these are more one-off rather than, you know, a major reform in the educational structure here in this country. But, you know, having these type of programs, like in Washington, D.C., with Cardoza High School that has a transportation program, are ways that we can link, you know, our education from early on through college to try to develop the skills that we need in the future.
We heard about Cardoza High School a little bit earlier in today's program. Can you describe to us the program that we're hearing about?
Not really totally, but what they have done is a pilot program in this high school to, you know, put together skills-based training to prepare, you know, students for entry into the transportation industry. You know, I don't have all of the information on the curriculum that they have, but it is a program that has been in place for a number of years now. They have a high success rate, and it's a, you know, a high school program, you know, that I was talking about that is directing students in the future to develop the skills that they need to enter the workforce.
When we talk about the attractiveness of the transportation industry as a career choice, what do you think of the media coverage in the transportation sector, and what stories are media missing?
Well, a lot of the stories are around what issues the system may be having today. I'm living that in Washington, D.C. And so one of the things I think is missing is there's not a lot of dialogue about the need for expanding and improving infrastructure in this country and about the problems that we're having staying competitive. You know, we haven't invested in transportation. I think some of the local initiatives are trying to address that in terms of funding, but in the meantime, what we're seeing in this country is that there is a lack of an investment in expanding and also keeping our infrastructure in a state of good repair.
That's very important. During your comments from the podium, you mentioned the high-speed rail and how it will be fully running in the next decade. In the past, there's been, it seems, a bit of friction between the Federal Railroad Administration and the Federal Transit Administration when it comes to funding different programs, research, workforce development, and education. Can you comment on that and how you'll work together since FTA will oversee the feeder systems for the high-speed rail line?
I think there's probably more cooperation now under this administration between the different modes. You know, each of the modes have different authorization structures. And what we have seen in the past is probably a little more of silos than we're seeing now. What we want to see in terms of the future, one of the changes in the FAST Act was trying to consolidate the financing side, which would be putting the railroad infrastructure funding program along with the transportation infrastructure financing and infrastructure act together, and so that, you know, our funding or financing side is going to be aligned. Also, you know, we're working very closely as a grant organization with the Federal Railroad Administration. Like, I was in Denver last week for the opening of their commuter rail. Well, FTA was the funder for that project, but FRA was actually, you know, responsible for the safety because, you know, they're sharing a freight right away. So we have to basically work cooperatively and partner in terms of ensuring that the projects are delivered and that we work together to ensure that the goal is to expand or enhance transportation in this country.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Speaking of infrastructure, what are your greatest challenges in improving transit infrastructure? Is it still funding that's the main challenge, or is it the lack of workforce available to complete the jobs?
Well, first of all, I would say funding is always going to be a major problem. Having a budget background and actually having to run budget for LA Metro and actually lead an agency and say, do I have all of the money that I need to do the job? And the answer is always, no, I don't. So I think that funding is a critical issue, but then also having the resources to deliver the service in the future is going to be an issue. Today we talked about, you know, the possibility of not having enough human capital to deliver the services in the future. But I think there will never be enough funding, but we also have the challenges of tackling how we're going to deliver those services in the future if we don't have adequate workforce to do so.
That's right. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program. Today's guest is Carolyn Flowers, Acting Administrator for the Federal Transit Administration. You can also find Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. Our next question, what advice do you have for workers who seek jobs in communities they cannot afford to live in? How is this being addressed by government?
Well, in some cases, there are cost of living adjustments, but I don't think those are always answering the question. I'm sometimes challenged. I'm living in Washington, D.C., and I hate to say this, but I'm living itty-bitty next to living in Charlotte, North Carolina. So, unfortunately, you know, as you go to areas that have differing cost of living, you basically are faced with the fact that you have to adjust your living style and the quality of living with these changes, the economic changes that you're facing. It is really difficult because I think that we are probably losing out on some skills and workforce because there are areas like San Francisco that are very, very expensive to live in. You know, the unions generally negotiate these cost of living differentials, but it is going to create a limitation on where people want to live and how they're able to get there. And so I don't think I really have an answer for that, but what I can say is it is a challenge for all of us. That we have to look at ways that we can attract workforce. And when you have the specter of a high cost of living, you have already put a major limitation or lid on your ability to attract the talent that you need.
Indeed. And in fact, when you look at the Silicon Valley Leadership Group annual survey, two key issues come up year after year. In fact, for the last 12 years, the cost of housing and transportation as impediments to being able to recruit, retain, and advance 21st century talent. Next question. You and Secretary Fox have strong backgrounds in local government and transit. How can that kind of experience and institutional knowledge be replicated for the next administration?
Well, we're all wondering what the next administration will be at this time. So, who will be leading the next administration? But one of the things that we're trying to do is to put together programs that are sustainable through the next administration and, you know, that are institutionalized so that they'll be carried on in the future. So the Ladders of Opportunity has many elements that we're looking at in terms of making sure that they're there for the future to provide, you know, programs that allow accessibility as well as, you know, trying to find a way to serve those who are underemployed or need transportation to get to jobs. And I think that's really, really key. I see that as something that can be sustained through the next administrations, you know, I say administrations, because it is One of the challenges that we're facing in this country is to ensure that we have, you know, access and ability to get people to jobs. And so I think that is something that will be there. The Secretary is also focused on safety as a priority, and I believe that will continue in future administrations. We want to ensure that, you know, that safety is a priority, that we reduce accidents and incidents. There's a focus on Vision Zero. And then we also look at technology, because one of the things that we see as we're looking for the future, and which was brought up in the Beyond Traffic blue paper, is that technology is so rapidly changing that if we don't adapt, the transportation industry will be left far, far behind. And so those are the three areas that I think, you know, working with the year or less than a year that we have left are going to be sustainable programs for the future.
How do you see autonomous vehicles impacting transit systems in the future, and what workforce challenges will autonomy bring?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because we were just touring Lyft earlier today, and we came upon the programmer who's working on autonomous vehicles. And so the National Highway Transit Safety Administration is working very closely with the vehicle industry and with Google to basically address the challenges of safety. Autonomous vehicles are coming, but we have to make sure that they're going to be safe. And so that is something that I think is a key part of this administration. They're working with the automotive industry to find ways to improve safety, but that's going to be the challenge, is how do we make it safe? But it's definitely on the horizon, and we're working very closely with the automotive industry to get there.
One of our audience members has asked that you comment on what's your view on the sharing economy, and specifically Uber and Lyft, and having that experience today.
Hello? Okay. Sharing economy. I do not have a car. I live in Washington, D.C., and this is my first time in my life not having a car. So I've been without a car now for about a year and a half. And it's one of the most freeing experiences you can ever have, especially if you grew up in California. Mm-hmm. So I have the option now of using public transit. I have my Metro card that is part of my benefits from work. I have my own personal Metro card. I have a membership with Uber. I have a membership with Lyft. I have a membership with Zipcar. So I have a whole array of options of getting around, plus walking and plus taxis. And so I have so many alternatives at my fingertip now that I think in the past we would have never considered. And so that's why I said public transportation is expanding its boundaries with the transportation network companies and with all of the new technology. We're able to craft a lifestyle that can be done without a car. Now, I may be moving somewhere in the future where I have to go back to the car, but in the meantime, I'm enjoying a lifestyle that allows me to have alternatives when I walk out my door.
Very good. Our next question is actually related to security. And given the state of our global economy, how is FTA addressing national security? But I'd like to add a component to that. What we see when we're talking about public surface transportation security is the proliferation of see something, say something campaigns and the effectiveness of those campaigns in thwarting potential terrorist activity. When you're talking about a constrained workforce and security issues, how does that all meld together to make sure Americans riding transit remain safe?
Well, let me start out and say that the Federal Transit Administration no longer has the responsibility for security. It's actually TSA that has responsibility for ground transportation security. However, we are working very closely with them. They're actually going through a process of issuing rules, and Congress is actually, since the Belgium incident, I think, you know, pushing that to be coming out a lot sooner. But when you're running a transit system, as I experienced in Los Angeles and in Charlotte, it doesn't matter if you're under FTA or under TSA, you have a responsibility to the public. And so you can take active means of trying to secure your system, which is very difficult with public transportation because there are open systems. We've seen what happened in Belgium. It's very easy to access public transit. Pay a fare, you're in the system. And so that is one of the, you know, key challenges of having security in your system. But, you know, there's also the passive security mechanisms in terms of cameras, your transit police who actually walk the trains. But the most effective way for someone to basically determine what's going on in the system is through either the employees or through riders. Riders tend to be taking the same line every day. The drivers are generally the same every day. And if there's something that is amiss, something that is different, they're likely to notice it. And that is why the See Something, Say Something campaigns are being pushed out there, because it's the daily rider on the platform, the daily rider on the line, who's likely to see something that they see is going to be different from their daily commute. And so I think that's why those campaigns will continue and why we think they're effective.
Fantastic. The Congress seems opposed to serious capital investment on sustainable transportation infrastructure. How can we meet our expanding transportation needs without serious federal assistance?
Well, it's a responsibility of everyone. You look at the industry, those original equipment manufacturers who are looking at ways to improve the emissions on vehicles. We're also funding through our grant programs low and no emission buses, and then it's you know, the responsibility. If we can get more people on public transit, we improve the climate, we reduce ozones, and so if we can come up with a more robust and viable network for public transportation, we have the ability to increase and improve sustainability in the future.
Very good. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we only have time for one last question. This is a question in regard to Japanese technology. Why reinvent the wheel when Japanese engineering and technology in a seismic active area has been proven to be leading edge in speed, operations, and safety? Why not have lessons learned from their workforce development strategies, buy their equipment and technology from proven sources?
Well, I think we are going to be learning from Japanese technology. I have written the Shinkansen, and you know, it's a very great line. But we also have a responsibility to our American workers and our American economy. And so, you know, part of the administration's goals are to increase Buy America, to have the technology and the jobs that, you know, we need here for economic development, and to increase our economic engine is to have the ability to actually make those things and provide jobs here in this country. And so I think other countries have learned from us in the past, but you know, they're making their own product and having their people be at work. And so we want to have the opportunity in this country to ensure that we can you know, boost our own economy and provide a means for economic development here and provide those jobs here in this country.
Very good. Our thanks to Carolyn Flowers, Acting Administrator of the Federal Transit Administration. Today's program is co-sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University and the Southwest Transportation Workforce Center at California State University, Long Beach. We want to thank our audiences here, on radio, television, and the internet. We also want to remind everyone in this room that we'll be taking a brief pause to reset the stage. We invite you to join us back here in 5 minutes. I'm Dr. Karen Philbrick, Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute, and your moderator for this portion of today's program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. That was great.